This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
War Stories, Episode 3, The End. In July 1916, New Zealand Sergeant Ted Ryburn was wounded and after a short spell in a British hospital in London, was sent to the 1st New Zealand General Hospital at Brockenhurst.
We had reserved carriages for Brockenhurst. Very hot journey. Arrived about 7:30 in a quiet little village. Inspected at the station by a doctor and ticketed for the different hospitals. I went to Central, Tin Town it's called. It's meant to be a hospital for bad cases. Consists entirely of corrugated iron huts. The other places, Barmer Lawn Hotel and Forest Park and Durrant, seem to be better. They are all within a mile of this place. The country is pretty. There are good walks, but it is deadly slow.
Ted was not the only one to initially complain about the pace of life and the quiet. But most of the doctors and nurses were New Zealanders who'd worked in the casualty clearing stations and field hospitals in the same theatres of war as the men and understood them in ways that took the soldiers time to appreciate. Small things, like putting men from the same regions or battalions in huts together, made a huge difference to recovery rates. The staff also knew, from personal experience, that it would take time for the constant noise of the big guns to be exchanged for the more natural sounds of barking dogs and twittering birds. Even the rain on the tin roof of the wards had a calming effect and helped men ease out of their constant state of vigilance.
Three or more operations in our ward this morning. My turn came just before dinner. In my back, one of the pieces of splinter was several inches below the original wound. The doctor cut and, to his astonishment, pulled out bits of cardigan and jacket as well. Said it was surprising that the wound had healed.
After a few days recovering, Ted was moved to Morant, another hospital that was in the village. There he started daily torture sessions of massage for his stiff right arm, but was also free to play endless games of tennis, billiards, and generally wander around.
There are only 70 of us here. The matron is very finicky, especially about hours, but one can put up with that since we have such a good time in other ways. The meals are luxurious compared with Tin Town. The difference between lady cooks and soldier cooks.
Mixing with the locals was also interesting.
Met a man who wanted to know if I knew a settler named Humphreys in the South Island.
But the war was never far away. As the battles in Europe intensified, there was a move to empty as many of the walking wounded from the hospitals as possible. Ted was slated to move to Hornchurch, another New Zealand hospital, to complete his convalescence.
Woke up about 6 and to my delight found there was no one astir. Had to get up early, so arose and sought out the chap who made a habit of pulling my bedclothes off me for the past week and thus starting the usual roughhouse in the morning. It's been the despair of the night sister for long past. Finished my job with him and went out and had a bath. On my way back, I waded through a pillow fight and was swinging a crusher on someone's nut when a biscuit mattress came whizzing from the bed of my former victim, caught me under the ear, lifted me off the floor and returned me to it sitting down. The pillow I was about to fling caught a man who was going out with me to Hornchurch, and he crashed down on his elbow and skinned it. Dressed in khaki again for breakfast. Afterwards, there was a hurry of stitching on stripes, button and cleaning same, packing up and saying goodbye to a happy home.
There was no happy home for those in France. That winter, Lance Corporal Will Anderson endured a series of long marches as the New Zealand Division moved in and around Messines. When not marching from one part of the country to another, he built trenches, took part in more night raids, and oversaw the training of new stretcher bearers to replace those who themselves had become casualties. When the 8th stretcher bearer numbers had dwindled from 8 to 4, those who remained were given 14 days leave. Will took the opportunity to visit relatives in Glasgow. Though he enjoyed the time away, there was also the knowledge that no matter how ordinary and enjoyable it was to play cards and socialise with family, he was always going back to the war. But back in New Zealand, for some men, like 31-year-old Canterbury farmer Ernie Stackhouse, signing up for the war was a way out of the mess his life had become. Ernie had been devastated by the recent death of his brother in an accident and had had to settle a very public breach of promise lawsuit brought by his fiancée. By the time the first conscripts' names were drawn from the ballot in November 1916, Ernie's 19th reinforcements had already left New Zealand, and in January he was marched into Sling Camp, where Ted Ryburn was now an instructor. Ryburn's opinion of the isolated army camp in the middle of the Salisbury Plains matched that of the men.
It is incessantly cold and we never see the sun, even on fine days. Milk freezes in the jugs in the mess. Ink all frozen, and this morning all the taps in the washing hub frozen. The frost lasts all day, and the rough ground is awful to march over. Chief concern is to keep warm. The adjutant said he was going to put me in charge of the pioneer detail, 120 Maoris, a ragtime rowdy lot that have gone their own sweet way for some time past and are very undisciplined.
Ted learned a lot from the pioneers.
Got news of a draft being sent out tomorrow. At about 9 p.m. got them all complete and fell in on the battalion parade ground with the other drafts from the different companies. At the last minute, one of my beauties went off down to the YMCA to post a letter leaving word with a mate that he would join them on the way down to the station. Thus, when the whole crowd had fallen in to march off and states called for, it had to be said there was one Maori absent who would pick them up at the YMCA. Enough to make a saint swear.
Ernie Stackhouse's 19th reinforcements stayed training at Sling for 2 months. Were then shipped to France at the beginning of March, where they did more training before Ernie joined the 2nd Battalion of the Canterbury Regiment and was at last free to fight something he could see. During his court case, Ernie had told the court that letter writing bored him, and the war did not change that. He was a man who preferred his actions to speak for him. All he needed was encouragement. Back at Sling Camp, Ted Ryburn was also interested in returning to the battlefield.
I'm fed up with affairs here. 19th expected any day. At present, I shall stay here with the pioneers. I heard a rumour that I was down for a bombing school, but it would mean taking an instructor's place here, and I don't want that. Once an instructor, always an instructor. I've got good prospects of promotion when I rejoin the unit.
On the 2nd of April, Ted turned 24.
This war is wasting an awful lot of good time. Third birthday in the army. Last two were both spent in Cairo. Even the Egyptian days seem so long past that I've all but forgotten them. And New Zealand, well, it's a lifetime since we left there. It will be a year since we landed in France. Of that year, I spent only 3 months in the trenches, so it is high time I was back.
Within a few weeks, Ted was accepted into officer training, after which he was guaranteed a return to France.
This makes all the difference in the world to me. Have recovered my keenness again after having felt absolutely stagnant.
Will Anderson had stayed on the Somme all year and was now hardened to the effects of war.
The feelings associated with experience such as those we had endured at the Somme are now accepted as normal. Newcomers go in with that fresh boyish appearance and come out with their youth left behind. The eyes tell the tale.
A series of battalion marches during October and a move to Ariane found the first Otagos recovering some of their lost spirit.
Starting off from Long Pre, our brass band, as usual, headed our column and livened our steps for the first quarter of a mile or so. Our pipe band in the rear then took over for a spell. When our pipe band reached Ariane, they celebrated in one of the pubs and in the morning to cure the hangover, took another dose of the same medicine. Starting out, they needed all the wind they could muster, just to march, and after a quarter of a mile there was even less for the windbag. The drummer needed no wind, and loud and clear came pum pum pum. Discipline and forces of habit outweighed discretion. There followed a wail from the bagpipes. Another three bangs on the drum indicated they were prepared to give it another go. The same wail as before was the limit of their ability, and we heard no more of them on that march. They heard us, though. Such a cheer arose from our ranks that with a little boosting here and there it would have reached the home of the pipes, if not the pipers. Nothing could have restored the battalion more than that.
Christmas Day 1916 was marked in Fleur Bay with plum duff and Boxing Day with a bath. On the 7th, Will was given 7 days' leave, which he spent in Glasgow with relatives. When he returned to his company in France, Will was intent on taking the most survivable course he could. This involved keeping his stretcher bearers safe, not only from the Germans, but also the army.
I learned to program our movements between the company and the headquarters so that we could enjoy maximum freedom. I would march the squad out with no questions asked of what we were up to. Our time was often spent in the warmth of a cafe, the stretcher placed behind the door and cups of milky coffee following each other. In the pleasant company of Madame and her two daughters, I reckon the morale of our squad reached its highest pitch.
Ernie Stackhouse was now well bedded into the 2nd Canterbury Battalion. Brought up in the hill country, he already had highly developed skills as a hunter and marksman, and it was soon realised he had an uncanny knack of hearing and seeing enemy movement. This led to him becoming an experienced patroller between the lines. In the area around Messines, the Allies were sending out big work parties to assemble new gun positions and extend the roads. It was obvious to everyone something big was about to happen, and the Germans did all they could to disrupt it.
I had gone to bed early, and had just gone off to sleep when Tom grabbed me by my shoulder.
"Wake up, Will! They're shelling the camp!"
If that had been the case, I would have needed no waking, but now I heard shells padding overhead. This was the first of a heavy strafe of our camp and the transport camp across the road from ours. We were shelled again at 12:30 and 3 a.m. After the strafing of our camps, we heard that the night before ours was shot up, all the German camps were given the same treatment by our artillery. The dumbest half-wit would know the Germans would retaliate. Why were we not told what to expect?
Despite these setbacks, the build-up continued. And on the eve of the attack, the Otago stretcher-bearers waited in a well-fortified bunker.
The night was quieter than usual, and it was like an earthquake when the mines were touched off and the massed machine guns opened up to lay down a barrage at the approaches to the town. We actually reached our objective without having any wounds to dress. It was a different take for the rest of the day. Where our mines had gone up, water was beginning to gather. It was tinted red from some cause or another, but to us it suggested blood. Chaplain McMenamin from Canterbury and one man from their burial party were killed, and another so shell-shocked that we had to strap him to the stretcher, for he had no control of his own nerve muscles. He was buried to his shins, and his boots were all the clothing remaining on him.
In England, Ted Ryburn completed his officer training course in a very New Zealand fashion. Having failed the Lewis gun portion, he was taken aside, given intensive training for an hour, then told he'd passed. He then went up to London.
Went into a shop and transformed myself into an Othitha by buying a new hat and red pug and sticking a couple of stars up on my shoulders. Spent the evening with music, New Zealand tales and strawberries, what?
But there was a part of Ted that wasn't entirely at rest.
Can't sleep these nights. Can't stand sheets somehow.
Sleep was also elusive for Will Anderson, who was caught more than once in a forward trench under a night bombardment.
There were three guns in the battery following each other. First one in front, then one to the right, and the third in our rear. Had they made any variation, they must surely have landed one amongst us. As it was nerve-wracking enough, particularly the last one that seemed to whiz just above our heads.
After the intensity of the heavy bombing that followed the initial Messines push, the Otagos were finally rested in the catacombs at Ploegsteert Wood. These were a series of spacious, connected hillside tunnels built by the Australians that were capable of holding up to 2,000 men.
The air had not the quality of that above, so I thought a spell in the open before tea time would be the caper. There were always the old cronies around to yarn the time away, but a wide plank leaning horizontally against the side of the drive invited a tolerably comfortable seat with a back to it. I carelessly listened to the sound of the howitzer, the flight of the shell and its explosion at our battery several hundred yards away. Then my ear registered a different tone. All I had time to do was turn my head. I felt nothing, and did not know I had been hit until I felt the blood rushing freely from my face. Losing no time, I got to my feet and found my left leg was not working normally.
In hospital, Will learned that his decision to sit on his own saved his life, as many in the group of old mates were killed by the stray shell. That same month, Ted Ryburn returned to the front as a newly minted second lieutenant.
Walked in the direction of Messine Ridge, had a lift in a lorry and was soon there. We are bivouacked in some fields surrounded by trees and the place looks like a country fair. Sports are being held and everyone looks fit. They are just doing working parties at night. We are several miles back and a good deal of shelling goes on. I won't be with the company for the first spell in the trenches as I am to go off to a school for 10 days or so. All new chums go through various schools shortly after arriving.
When Ted returned, he was straight back into it.
Just starting when I met my platoon sergeant being brought in wounded. He had left a lance corporal in charge. With a stretcher bearer as a guide, I soon found my post. They were having the first lull of the day. Reported to Company HQ, then we set about doing what we could for our trench. It was a little affair, perhaps 30 yards long, full to a depth of over one knees with thick porridgey mud. The ditch was only breast high, and we scraped little hollows to sit in the sides and collected sleepers from the neighbouring railway line that had been blown to bits to give us footing. Got comparatively comfortable, as well as one can when up to his knees in wet. Worst part was that wet rations had not come out and we had practically nothing to drink. The lull continued for an hour or two, and then intermittent shelling and machine gun fire commenced for the night. Of course, sleep was out of the question, and just before daylight, we got what we afterwards learned to look for as his daybreak strafe. It was frightful. All one could do was to hang on crouching in one's hole, watch the time crawling along and think he wouldn't keep it up for long. Extraordinary how quiet it was when it was over. We got dry rations and doled them out. Still nothing to drink except what might be left in the water bottles. Of all extraordinary things, a letter for me from England came up with the rations. Queer getting a letter in a place like that. Before I could open it, I had almost obliterated it with my muddy hands. We then settled down for an endless day. You can't know how long a day is unless you are forced to sit cramped up in one spot with nothing to do except listen to Fritz's shells.
The German offensive relentlessly continued.
The shelling was heavy all night, and about 3 a.m. began the most awful strafe I and any of our people had ever seen, even on the Somme. We're all convinced that Fritz was coming over, and the SOS went up from our HQs. Soon the whole place was covered with a dense cloud of fumes. The smell was rotten, and the ground was chewed up to bits. Whole fields without a patch of the original surface showing. Now only huge craters, lip to lip filled with trees and all sorts of debris. We were drenched with dirty water and covered with black dust and mud from shell bursts, and the most wonderful thing of all, not a man scratched.
In September, the New Zealand Division began training for the Third Battle of Ypres, a battle known in New Zealand as Passchendaele. The objective for the New Zealanders was the ridge straddling the Ravenbeek stream with the town of Passchendaele behind. This was an advance of about 2,500 yards, involving both Ryburn's 2nd Battalion Otago's and the 2nd Canterbury Battalion, to which Ernie Stackhouse belonged. Shortly after the initial attack on the 3rd of October, it began to rain heavily, turning the battleground into a mass of sticky, rancid mud and filling the deep shell holes with water. On the ridge, the Germans' machine guns were firing from concrete pillboxes beyond which was laid at least 30 yards of wire. Allied artillery was supposed to break the wire, but the guns had had to be manhandled through the muddy slime, and not all had made it to the front. When those that had were set up, there was no firm ground, which meant with each firing, the trajectory changed and they sunk deeper into the mud. The men too were carrying heavy kits that dragged them down and made it difficult to move. They set off at dawn and by 10 had made barely 200 yards. At the end of the day, 846 men were killed and 2,000 were wounded. Leonard Hart of 2nd Otago's wrote home, "All my company officers were killed outright. One of them, the son of the Reverend Ryburn of Invercargill, was shot dead beside me." Ted had died leading his men into battle. Ernie Stackhouse came through the assault physically unscathed and became one of the old hands. He and his mate, Tot Brown, carried on patrolling, seeking out German forward listening and observation posts and bringing back valuable information. On one raid, Ernie captured a German officer and his maps. He was told his actions were worthy of a military medal. Pragmatic Ernie turned it down in favour of something he knew he had a chance of living to see. A Christmas leave in Paris. A few months later, in 1918, Ernie was critically wounded in the leg and chest. He also developed pneumonia, which in the days before antibiotics was very difficult to treat. In August 1918, he was sent back to New Zealand and invalided out of the army. His leg wounds never properly healed, and many years later the limb was amputated. His army discharge only mentioned illness, and he did not receive any of the assistance offered other similarly wounded servicemen. Will Anderson was also back in New Zealand when the First World War ground to a close in 1918 with the signing of the armistice on the 11th of November. For Ernie Stackhouse, the memories that endured and were passed on to his family were of the senseless and brutal loss of life suffered at Passchendaele and the way he was treated by the army. For the family of Ted Ryburn, his father said there was comfort in his diaries, knowing what he had been doing for almost every day they were apart. The diaries certainly showed Ted was a young man with an incredible zest for living, who, had he survived, would have been a great asset to New Zealand. His body was one of the few that was buried in the days following his death, but it is doubtful he is beneath his headstone in the Commonwealth War Grave Cemetery at Tynecott. As for Will Anderson, the man who had gone through most of the war without a rifle, he returned home, determined to make the most of a life so many of his mates no longer had. In his 50s, he went into Milford Sound to manage Quentin Huts, and it was there that he finally found his place. He was almost 90 years old when he left the Milford Track, having hopefully made some kind of peace with those tumultuous years of war. This podcast was written by Brockenhurst RSA Scholarship recipient Robin Anderson. The memories of Will Anderson were taken from personal diaries and writing of William Anderson and voiced by Jack Milner. The words of Ted Ryburn were voiced by Henry Warner and based on the personal diaries of Eric Middleton Ryburn, which are located in the New Zealand National Archives and in the Imperial War Museum in London. The narration was voiced by me, Mark Aldridge. Special thanks to Roz and Di and the members of St Nicholas Parish Church, Brockenhurst, Lorraine Maguire, the Christchurch Historical Society, and the Twin City Committee from Christchurch, Dorset, for their assistance and support.